Very good, John. You got it? The book we're studying, but it will help us connect vividly with this meditation of resting in simple, basic, unadorned awareness. He says, when we engage in the practice of discovering space, we should develop the feeling of opening ourselves out completely to the entire universe. So let's do that. State of complete receptivity with no limit. And back to Dingo Chense, he says, we should open ourselves with absolute simplicity and nakedness of mind. We'll come back to that quote in our studies, but right now we're just gonna let ourselves rest in that feeling of open, limitless awareness, open, limitless space. So we are studying verse 14 today. This is the verse. This is the exact actual verse that made me want to really go deeply into the 37 practices of a bodhisattva after some turmoil at the monastery earlier this year. I think we've all been in that position in one way or another. So this is a really important verse to me personally. This was my inspiration for really wanting to integrate, internalize these verses and integrate this practice into my being so that when I need it, I'll have it. So we'll recite the verses. I'm going to share the screen again. And what we're going to do today to give us a little more time for study and contemplation is instead of chanting all of every verse, we're just going to chant the last bit of every verse, the part that is the actual naming of the practice. So we'll see how that works out. And it may not be clear. I'll do my best to hit the right line to start with every time. It's usually the second or first or second line from the end. So first one, to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So you could do it with the tune. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Practice 3, on solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Verse 4, to let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Verse 5, not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Verse 6, to hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. That would be spiritual friends. Verse 7, to seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. That completes the preliminaries. So now the three levels of motivation for practice. From harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. To strive in all our efforts just for that, this is the way a bodhisattva trains, and that is to strive for unchanging freedom, liberation. Verse 10, to cultivate the mind of full awakening, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So the mind of full awakening is wisdom plus compassion. Verse 11, we're going to chant the whole verse from here on, because we're now entering bodhisattva boot camp. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times my wealth, good deeds, and merit, everything. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Last week's verse. So I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong. Without a cause, someone cuts off my head to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And this week's verse, we'll do this one three times. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back, I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back, I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back, I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So, we are now, I got an email, it looks like it might have been from Fanny, so I'm just going to see there. Yeah, I'm not sure. All right. All right, so we have a contemplation for this week. I don't know if everybody had a chance to look at the website and give it some thought. The contemplation is to remember, if it's ever happened to you, to remember a time when you were unjustly accused and made a scapegoat among coworkers or friends. Has this ever happened to anybody? You got blamed for something, and it was, Valerie's raising her hand. Blame for something and unjustly means you didn't do it. Like in this case, you didn't do it. We've got a verse coming up where you did do it. How to handle that one, which is not very different from how to handle this one. How to handle all of them is pretty much the same. But in this case, you didn't do the thing. You're unjustly accused, and it just runs away. It becomes broadcast throughout the entire universe. So the contemplation, and we can do that for a moment in case people didn't have a chance, just to remember, like if you can come up with a time that that happened. If you can't, then maybe you could just imagine that happening to you. So how does it feel? The injustice of it and the shame of it. To have people think you did a terrible thing that you didn't do. Or just a mistake that cost your business or just made people upset. And if you can remember it, or if you can imagine it, like how did you react at the time, or how would you react? If you did anything about it, did you defend yourself? Did you lash out? Did you retaliate? Did you hide? And whatever you did in reaction to this unjust accusation, did it resolve the situation? Whatever way you engaged with it. And if it really did happen to you, is it still alive now? Like when you think about it, does it hurt to think about it? I mean, it could even be something really small. Sometimes these things are so trivial. You know, somebody thinks you used the last paperclip and you didn't do it. It wasn't you. Somebody thinks you forgot to buy milk And actually, the store was out of milk, but they don't let you explain that. It's not your fault. But they're really, really upset. So if you're remembering a situation like that, something that actually happened, big or small, you know, maybe it was big and like the entire Twitter universe came down on you. Can we relate to that in a positive way now, like to the memory of it? And I find this so helpful when I do remember things from the past that made me suffer, perhaps unjustly, or I feel they were unjust. Can we apply taking and sending retrospectively? I find that such a useful tool. Just the emotion comes up, the anger or the hurt or the grief or the sadness or whatever it is, however you'd characterize it, the anxiety, the shame. Can we just breathe that in? Like that's just the way it is. We breathe it in and dissolve it just as we would any suffering that's happening in the present. And breathe out to ourselves whatever equanimity we possess. Breathe out to ourselves awareness of our Buddha nature. Breathe out to ourselves whatever we need to feel better. And Ken McLeod is going to give us such a fabulous sort of a guided meditation on this, a way to deal with this, which we'll look at a little later. And so that's what we can do whenever any kind of suffering, any kind of hurt, fear, anger arises, past, present, or future, something you're worried about. Like this, I know this person is going to do this tomorrow when I show up and I'm already upset about it. Can we just breathe that in and breathe out to ourselves the antidote, the remedy, so that like our mind comes to rest? And can we breathe in the other person's suffering? Like beyond that, once our own mental state is somewhat stabilized and we have the wherewithal to open up our awareness, can we think of the other person and what's causing them to react the way they are? Do they have suffering, you know, or do they have some kind of negative situation that they're dealing with? I mean, even just their upset, even if it's unjustified, can we breathe that in too? And breathe out the remedy to them, whatever they need. And our teachers, whose commentaries we're going to look at, sometimes take it even further, as I talked about in the class notes. Trungpa Rinpoche says you can apply this to actually like taking blame for something you didn't do. He says he's done it thousands of times personally. Somebody accuses you, took the last paperclip. Now there aren't any paperclips. I'm so upset. I'll never speak to you again. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't realize it was the last paperclip, because it wasn't. But, you know, whatever it is that someone's upset, can you actually take the blame? And that can be really hard if it's a big thing, especially. And what does that mean to take the blame? How far do we go with that? Trungpa Rinpoche doesn't seem to set a limit. He says, just take it. There may be situations when that wouldn't work or wouldn't be advisable. You know, we get into the doormat thing sometimes there. So again, there's always like a line that you're having to try to identify, like to act like a bodhisattva without turning it into a situation where you're feeding someone else's ego clinging in a negative way. So here's the big question. You know, we've read the commentaries and we're going to study and discuss them today. What if it happens tomorrow? How are we going to react? Like, is reading the commentaries and sort of and knowing this verse going to help us in the moment if this happens tomorrow and all of Twitter turns against us? Everybody in the world is like, knows about what we're said to have done, and they all think we're a horrible person. They all want an apology, and even if we apologized, it wouldn't help. what will we do if it happens tomorrow? We need to keep that like really in the forefront of our mind with all of these practices. What if it actually happens? Like, and we come back to the same question we had about some of the earlier verses. Does he mean it literally? Does he really mean it? Like, we literally take the blame. We literally don't defend ourselves. So I'm going to open this up for discussion. I have some other thoughts about where the boundaries might be with this, because I think there can be boundaries, like reasonable boundaries. But I'm going to open it up for discussion now and unmute everybody. And if I hear noise, I'll just selectively mute. All right, we're unmuted.
I have something.
Kathy.
My husband, Bob, was he could do that all the time. He just, and I've really believed that he was brought up, his mother died really early, his dad, you know, he had to become a part of the breadwinning thing early on, like by the time he was 12. And he was treated like an adult. And, you know, I had the total opposite growing up, and, you know, and my father was very abusive. So he always laughed and said I had this hair trigger.
Yeah.
And I, you know, somebody would blame me and I'd be right there. Yeah. And he would take the blame for anything. It didn't matter, big, small. He'd just say, what's the difference? Just take it. Get it over with. Then it's done. It's diffused. If you don't have, you know, it's that deal with if somebody has something to punch against, you're in trouble. But if you're this,
yeah,
you're not.
I like that graphic. I like that graphic.
Yeah. So anyway, that, and it took me years to be able to, not certainly not do it the way he could do it, but do it at all.
Yeah.
So I know the power of that. That would be my answer to what do you do tomorrow? Yeah, just take it and get rid of it.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Was that Dave?
That was Dave.
We haven't seen Dave in a while. Hi, Dave.
Come and say hi, Dave.
Well, if he just got up, he might not want to be on camera. That's all right.
There he is.
Hey, Dave, how you doing?
Isn't it good? You can come and join us if you feel like it.
I'll listen.
Yeah,
no
yeah.
Pressure, no pressure. It does help, Kathy.
Good.
Huh? I think, Kathy, it does help to have like a living example, especially.
Oh, my word, yes. Household. I mean, I could never have imagined that without him.
Yeah.
Never.
That it could be done.
Like that it could be done.
That
would, yeah.
I also have a close relationship with someone who's like that. At work, totally blame me, fine. It just takes all the tension out of the situation. Like it's been a very beautiful thing. And what I find is that like everybody's involved not with your ego, but with their own ego.
Right.
And when you're the one who gives in, they don't feel bad about you. It doesn't make them feel bad about you. It just makes them feel good.
Yeah.
That's done. You're not become a villain. It's not a lasting thing. You simply took the tension out of the situation.
Exactly. So
I'm not saying I'm good at this. I can be a very defensive person.
Yeah, but see, I really believe this is all those years of taking it. And having to protect yourself.
Yes, those of us who grew up with like serious
abusive parents,
it's kind of hardwired, I think.
So
anyway. Anybody else have anything they'd like to say? Yes, Dan.
I this morning I had a lady yelling at me a lot. Not my wife, but it was
time.
No, on Thursdays, the where her preschool is, they have like a food pantry. So it's like a, It's like people come in, they like can shop, and depending on the size of their family, they get so many groceries for free and stuff.
Yeah.
So there's a lady who got passed over a lot today, I guess, in line. She was irate, so I was shopping with her, so I told her she was yelling, so I told her she could just yell about it at me. So.
Like, and then, you were the one to blame?
Yeah, because there's like she was trying to push other people over. It got kind of intense. I was like, you can yell at me. She was, and then she was, but then she was okay. She kind of settled down after she realized that it wasn't such a big deal.
That may have also injected a little humor into it that she was actually able to.
Yeah, I was like, just relax. And she's like, I will not relax. I was like, okay, I'm sorry. So, but yeah, so that was kind of intense right off the bat this morning. But
yeah.
Yeah.
You had studied the verse. You had done some drawings. And, you know, I noticed.
There you go. It's all about the drawings. And the verse. So.
Okay, well, yeah. Great. That sounds great.
Yeah.
You know, you were able to do it.
In this yeah.
To take the blame that wasn't really yours.
Yeah, I got lucky saying the right thing, I think. I was on the spot a bit, so.
Valerie, you had something?
Yeah, I would like to have gone to that situation now because of the Buddhist teachings, I would handle it way better. Way better.
Yeah.
So.
We like to think so. I mean, you know, we have to also realize that a lot of this is at an intellectual understanding. Because, you know, I've been a student of Buddhism and for like 40 years. And I've studied the 37 practices many times. But I have to say, like, so it got so hot at KTC after the April meeting. And I was the target of so much blame, like bitter, nasty blame. I didn't do anything. I feel like I didn't do anything. You know, maybe there's a case to be made that I did something wrong, but people just needed to vent and to find somebody to blame. I was really interested in a community of Buddhist practitioners. That was sort of the first place an awful lot of people went, was who can I blame for this? And how can I make them feel really, really bad? I have to say, I didn't live up to the verse, but in retrospect, I mean, I felt like a complete failure at the time. But then in retrospect, as I'm now really going into depth studying the verse, I realized that I didn't flunk. I can't say I threw myself into loving people who were sort of hating on me, but I didn't retaliate, and I may have had some anger. Anger may certainly have arisen at various times. I didn't dwell on it or act on it. It was more like I had to get away from it because of my early life situation. I have PTSD. Like many people, and I had to get out of Dodge. So I left earlier than I had planned to leave because it just really got too nasty. And that was what I had to do for myself, for my own survival. But I realized that I didn't do anything bad. I didn't lash out at anybody. I didn't think other people were bad people. I understood people were coming from a place of suffering and you know, loss, like great grievous loss. And I did feel that a lot of people didn't take the time to really look at the situation like and sort of analyze it in any kind of rational manner. People were just reacting out of their emotional trauma. Mm-hmm. And they needed somebody to be the recipient of that. That was a bit of a surprise. But I think that's just the way the world is. I mean, that's the first note of truth, is it ain't gonna ever be pretty. You know, it's never gonna be perfect. It's never gonna be just. We're never gonna have justice. I'm sorry, but we really are never gonna have that. Never gonna be smooth. It's never gonna be what we want. So it was actually, even at the time I realized that it was a fabulous field of practice, like this is the practice. You know, how lucky would we be to actually live these experiences that Tokmei Zanpo is taking us through? Because you learn an awful lot about yourself. You see your limitations so clearly. And that's really good, because when you intellectually understand these things, you could think, yes, tomorrow I'm going to deal with it better. And Valerie, I'm sure that we all will deal with it better. Whether we can actually live up to the ideal is another question. I mean, I think we do all get it, and it will help us. But man, when you are just when it's in your face, 40 years of Dharma practice, like, that can happen. But I think 40 years of Dharma practice makes for a very quick recovery. Like, you get back on your feet and you see what's happening and you go, this is exactly verse 14 of the 37 practices. So what do I do? Let me look it up. What do I do? So anybody have any other thoughts on this? Anything else they'd like to share? All right, well, if not, then we will go on to the commentary. Let me see if there is any more. So I just wanted to say that the quote that I read from Dingo Chensei in the meditation, I'm going to read that again with the last line, because even though it's not from this text, it applies exactly to this verse. So he said, and we can do this as we're hearing it, when we engage in the practice of discovering space, we should develop the feeling of opening ourselves out completely to the entire universe. And we can do that even as we're studying and talking. We should open ourselves with absolute simplicity and nakedness of mind. So what if we could do that with somebody screaming in our face when we didn't do the thing? And all we want to do is defend ourselves. All we want to do is say what really happened. I can think of God so many times that I've been in this situation and didn't handle it very well. Well, he says, so he goes on to say, this is the powerful and ordinary practice of dropping the mask of self-protection. And that is, to me, exactly what this verse is about. It's about not needing to protect ourselves. And why don't we need to protect ourselves? Well, the ultimate reason we don't need to protect ourselves is actually the commentary from the previous verse, verse 13, where Dingo Chensei in particular went into, there is no I. There is no actual existing, continuous, identifiable self that is the recipient of any of this stuff. And both Dingo Chensei and Ken McLeod are going to address this more in the commentaries, but not in such depth as in the last verse. There's nobody there. You know, like 100 years from now, the thing didn't happen. Like a week from now, the thing didn't happen in a lot of cases. Like, you know, an hour from now, it's like you forgot it. You're on to the next thing. In the moment, it feels so important. And if something is really happening to you, and then it's gone. And that's the dreamlike character of it. So the dreamlike character, that's wisdom. That's the wisdom. And the compassion component is where we recognize the other person's suffering and feel for them and do whatever we can to make them feel better. And we're not giving away the store. And I think maybe it's Ken who gets into this in a very beautiful way. One of the commentaries does. We're not really giving away anything. It's just like there's nothing there. There's no substance there that we could grasp onto. There's nobody that's really being hurt by anything. And so we're just relaxing and opening. We're opening ourselves out completely to the entire universe. Like the entire universe is coming at us. And we're just like, drop the what are they called in Star Trek? You know, drop the force fields and activate the force fields. Like, let it all just come. Let it hit the target. Like, and then you realize there's no target. That's the wisdom part. There is no target. And there's no one targeting and there's nothing coming at you. Kathy looks like she's having a conversation.
Dave was just shouting out shield.
Shield. Put out the shield.
Mr. Sulu. Mr. Sulu.
They're down to 30%, Captain.
Yes. Well, don't you feel that way some days? And the great news is, like, you don't even need 30%. Can just be completely inert. Just like, I just love this line, the feeling of opening ourselves out completely to the entire universe with absolute simplicity and nakedness of mind. This is the powerful and ordinary practice of dropping the mask of self-protection. It's dropping the force field. We could say the force field of self-protection. Like, just turn the thing off, save the energy. We're solar powered. So anybody got anything else before we look at the commentaries? I got my books again, and we're not all Kindle all the time now, which is a lot easier. Oh, I didn't put my bookmark in. All right. Define verse 14. Here we are on page 121, if you have the Dingo Chensei. And his translation, the translation here by the Padmakara Translation Committee, I'm just going to read it. It's a little different, but you know, having different translations is really helpful because, you know, they just give you a slightly different angle. Even if someone says all sorts of derogatory things about me and proclaims them throughout the universe, in return, out of loving kindness, to extol that person's qualities is the practice of a bodhisattva. So instead of putting up the force field that repels whatever is coming at you, you put up the love field that absorbs whatever is coming at you and just turns it into more love. Like, wouldn't that be great? Valerie, I'm going to unmute you. Oh, I'm going to try. Here we go. Oh.
Trying to.
Okay, got you.
I can always find the compassion and understand that these people are not happy, which is where this is coming from. Yeah. But yeah. I would be a liar to say that I love them.
Yeah. Fake it till you make it, right?
You think?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That is the Buddha's teaching. Yeah, that's what all of these are fake it verses. We are faking these reactions until we get there. Like, if anybody's there, that's absolutely fabulous. I am not. I would have to fake all of these. Verse 12, give them everything you got. My first reaction would not be that.
Because I feel personally kind of annoyed when people come with that, like, holier than thou and that all that kind of behavior, because it doesn't ring true to me.
Yeah, now we're getting into the nitty gritty. Thank you, Valerie. Yeah, this is an important point. Like, is it fake? Like, are we, because I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. I don't think we're not making a show of sending them love. You know, but we're just, I mean, we could just be holding our own and struggling internally to connect with the love that is there. It may not be easy to direct it at that person at that moment, but that love is there. We always, that's what we're made of, is wisdom and love and compassion. You know, that's our basic nature. So it's there. Connecting with it in a particular situation is the trick. And so I think the advice here, and I'm pretty sure I've heard this from one or two teachers at least, is if you can't find it, just make it up. Send them, you know, the facsimile of love. And again, you're not making a show of it, like, oh, I love you so much. You know, it's just like you're just not doing the opposite. So you're just trying to connect with love in your heart. But Valerie, that's such a good point. We're not... It can feel hypocritical, like it's not really coming from our heart. We are pretending. I don't think that's a bad thing. Like, wouldn't you rather have somebody, well, I don't know, maybe this isn't true. But you do something to offend someone and you know that they're offended, but wouldn't you rather have them react from a place of more equanimity, whatever they may be feeling inside, rather than lashing out? I don't know, that may vary from person to person. I would rather not have somebody like hit me, even if they feel like it. Somebody was that you, Chet? Okay, Chet, and then Kathy.
I may have hinted at this before, but I've been in recovery a very long time, and that's a classic phrase from all recovery movements, and it's a really sound psychological principle that really your thoughts follow your actions.
Right.
So that, you know, faking it till you make it is an act of, I mean, that's of also relying on your elders, so to speak.
those with more experience.
Right. That this is a path that people have used. So if you fake it like they have done it, then eventually it works. And it does.
Yeah. Yes, I believe in that too. I still think Valerie has like a valid point that's in there that, you know, you don't want to fake it so much that the other person feels like you're faking it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think it's more about a self, at some level, it's a selfish perspective. You're yeah. trying to act as if, even if you don't aren't there yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't certainly overdo it.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to totally overdo it. Kathy, you had something? Still unmuting. I think you have to do it from your end. Okay.
I did. I think I find for myself that if I can just take a minute and breathe and get into my heart, get out of my head, get out of myself, get into that, you know, that heart space and respond from there, then you're not, you know, you're not dealing with it from the same level. You're not trying to fix the problem from where the problem is. You're,
yeah.
you know, you're letting it dissolve. It's kind of the same thing as Bob just taking the blame for anything. You know, yeah, it's like.
It sounds like he's at the point where he doesn't even feel it as blame.
No. It was astonishing to me. I couldn't even imagine it.
It literally doesn't bother him.
No, it did not.
Oh, I see Anne has a comment too. We're coming to you, Anne. I'm going to try to
And I think, too, when you aren't ready to really feel any love for someone, maybe you're still angry or whatever at them. I've done things where I've been wrong, and then I apologize or whatever, and the person said, oh, well, it's okay, but it's all right. But they're still really angry, and I know they are. So I think we can go that far to try to just say it's all right.
Yeah.
Even if we don't feel real love in our heart for the other person,
yeah,
at the time,
yeah,
not really. And it's hypocritical in a way, but not really.
Yeah,
but it is all right. You are letting it go, even though you're still angry.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. I'm going to mute you again, and just say that I think that Trungpa Rinpoche, I think so that he doesn't. I mean, he says that. Sometimes when you take the blame, it takes the tension out of the situation, and then you can talk about it from a realistic point of view. But something has to happen to allow that rational discussion to take place. And so sometimes, like taking the blame initially, just accepting it, despite what you may feel, allows for a deeper discussion. And I also... And this probably, I probably got this from somebody, but I came up with this rule many years ago, which has held true, I think, a lot, that there's just certain kinds of exchanges have to happen in a difficult conversation. And so if you're the one who says, like, either you're going to say you're wrong or the other person is going to have to say you're wrong. So once you say you're wrong, that frees up the other person, and then they're going to be the one to volunteer what you would have said to them. Like if you were going to have a back and forth with them. I don't think I'm being really clear here, but, you know, if you say I'm not wrong, then they have to, they yell at you, and then you say, but you did this, but this is really your fault because you contributed this to it. But if you just don't do that, if you don't come back at them, if you don't defend yourself and you just say, yeah, sorry, I was wrong, then they very often are the one who says, yeah, but you know, I also owe you an apology because, in fact, that happened to me today. Same thing happened today, this morning. A neighbor did some work while I was in Texas, some house painting and repair and so forth. And he came over this morning to get paid, and I picked up the wrong total, and I underpaid him by like $100. And he got to the bank, and it's like, this isn't all the money. And he called me, and he was upset about it. He was nice, but he was upset. And I'm like, oh, and I pulled out the bill and I said, oh yeah, I see how I did that, because the bill is kind of, you know, that wasn't helpful. I should have just said, oh, sorry. Sorry. And so round two, you know, when he came over to pick up the second check, I was like, I'm so sorry. And by that point, he was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I should have like structured the bill differently. So we were both like in total apology mood. But if I had just said, I'm sorry, oh darn, and not even gone into like, actually, I can see why I made the mistake, it would have been a very short conversation. Everybody would have been happy. But we fixed it in round two. Like, I just did the total abject, oh, I'm so sorry, it's my fault thing. It was really good. So, got to know John has something to say.
Okay, yeah. If we're taking the blame, although we didn't do it, then we'd be lying. But because it's coming from good intention, then it's not, the karmic effect would be less. Is that
that's a fabulous question.
is that the reasoning here?
Wow, you know, I would have to really think about that a bit. I think you've brought up, you know, like nothing is like 100% cut and dried because it's samsara. Like it's always going to be confusing and you can't pin the thing down. But I think in this case, Trump definitely says, yes, say I did it. And that is a lie if you didn't do it. He doesn't go into that. He's thinking more, I think, about what is most beneficial in the situation. So, yeah, but I think that's a really good question. I'm not sure if you would actually incur negative karma in this kind of a situation. I personally would not worry about it, but I do think it's a really good question because when you get into like the torch of certainty and Zhangong control, it's like 100%. You know, if you look at the, especially at the deeper explanations in Gampopa of karma, every lie carries some karma with it, some negative karma. So, like you say, no, those pants don't make you look fat. Like you've just incurred some negative karma, but you've done the compassionate thing towards someone, you know, or yeah, great haircut or whatever. Like, yes, I used the last paperclip. I ate the last ice cream. I can't solve that. I mean, I don't have 100% answer for that. I think so many situations are going to be like that where we have to weigh two things against each other and just do the best we can. Namdok may have some helpful comment here.
I don't think it's very helpful, but I think the karma must be very minuscule. Yeah. because then you have the positive karma of the fact that you said those pants don't make you look fat. You have the positive karma of making somebody feel good.
Yeah.
But there could be cancel each other out.
Yeah, there could be situations where what you're doing is totally feeding their ego clinging in a negative way. Like you're giving into something that actually is not good for them. I don't think any of the situations we've talked about are that. But there are times, like when we give ground, like say somebody, I don't know, I'm trying to come up with something that's not going to be offensive to anybody or triggering to anybody, but you know, like if you, like codependency, let's say codependency, like that's a place where you could actually be helping somebody feel good about themselves in a way that makes them, that is destructive to them, feeds their self-destruction. So I don't think it's going to be 100% clear a lot of the time, and we just have to do our best. And we keep studying and contemplating and meditating, and it clarifies more and more. And hopefully we have teachers we can go to help us sort things out. I'm afraid I'm not at the level of being able to really answer John's question. But John, it brings up a great contemplation here and a great discussion. To always bear karma in mind, too, what we've been taught about karma. All right, anybody else before we go on to the commentaries? So I said in my, I'm going to mute everybody then for now. And of course you can unmute yourself. Okay. In the class notes, I point out, if everybody read the notes on verses 12 through 19, the overview, then you'll note that these first four verses of Bodhisattva Boot Camp, 12 through 15, are they're the eight worldly concerns or the eight worldly dharmas, you know, which is like the most basic level at which our ego manifests. That and they are loss and gain. We're happy when we get something and we're unhappy when we lose something, be it money or be it an argument or a point or whatever. We're happy when we feel good, when things are pleasurable, and we're unhappy when things don't feel good, when we're having some kind of suffering or pain. And then there's praise and blame. We're happy when people praise us and we're unhappy when people criticize us. I mean, this is true, right? We feel these things. And this is what the Dharma is all about, evening out, like understanding that none of it means anything. Can y'all hear the dog barking? All right, I'm going to just close the window. Wasn't easy. That should help. And then this is the one, this is actually the fourth set, which is translated different ways, but it's fame and disgrace, or fame and being unknown, like just nobody noticing you. It's explained both ways. So the eight worldly concerns are like, they are a way of measuring how far we have traveled on the path, like how much work we still have to do. If somebody praises us and it makes us feel all happy, and somebody blames us and it makes us feel all sad, we still have work to do. If we care what our reputation is, whether like the Twitter universe is for us or against us, then we have more work to do. And if we get upset when we lose something that we wanted, or we're really just overjoyed when we get something, I mean, that's the good side is just as problematic as the bad side, like really being just really, really happy. Like there's a better word for this, but I can't think of it. You know, we get the job and we're just ecstatic. If we can think ahead, like something's going to be wrong with this, there's going to be a flaw in this, so I might as well expect that, it helps us. That's equanimity, like not getting too far this way and not getting too far this way. So we can keep, if you know the eight worldly concerns, and I linked them, my little row, row, row your boat song. I linked them in one of the teachings, one of the class notes. If you know those, then you can use them. And so these first four verses epitomize those. They represent those. And this one is a good or bad reputation, like fame, good kind of fame, good renown. Renown would be good. Renown versus disgrace. So I just wanted to point that out in case people haven't had a chance to read the notes. So we just have about 20 minutes left. We're just going to breeze through the commentaries. Mostly I think we're going to look at Ken McLeod's, because not everybody has that one to read and because it's so vivid and helpful. But first, just pointing out that both Ningbo Chenzi and Geshe Jampa Tegchok start off with the same reminders that we get for all of them, and they're the same reminders in Gampopa's chapter on patience, like how to cultivate patience. Remember karma. Something bad happens to you, karma is your go-to. I did something like this to someone in the past, and through being injured in that same way, I've paid it, I'm paying it off. So it's actually good. And also I earned this. Like nobody's innocent. So you take the blame. So John, it helped to answer your question a little bit. We're always to blame. You know, there's always some karmic reason why we're in this situation that we're in. So taking the blame might be a way to just roll with that. Like, okay, maybe I didn't take the last paperclip this time, but I must have done it in a previous lifetime. So you can just say, I did it. And you don't know which lifetime you're referring to. You know, so I must have done it sometime. So I'm just going to take the blame now. So karma is one. And the other one, Dingo Chensei doesn't mention, but Geshe Jampa Tegcho mentions, the other person is not in control of themselves. They would not act this way. They would not start a Twitter war with you or about you if they could put themselves in your place, or if they really had the faculties to understand the full situation. Like this is somebody else acting out of their own incomplete understanding, their own ego, their own suffering. So those two things are like really big helps whenever we get into any kind of adversity, especially when it involves injustice. He also gets into emptiness a little bit. He says, so remember that whether you have a good reputation or a bad one, it has no objective reality at all. It is not worth caring about. The great teachers of the past never bothered about such things. They always answered slander and disparagement with kindness and with patience. Now, Dingo Chenzi doesn't get into taking blame, like overtly taking blame. That's Trungpa Rinpoche. who goes into that one in his commentary on the 7 points of mind training, which is called Training the Mind, which is one of my favorite books of all time. he's the one who goes into taking the blame, actually. And he along the same lines, he says, some people spend all their energy and even risk their lives to achieve fame. Or, you know, to achieve fame in the sense that everybody thinks you're a good person. Everybody thinks you're a great teacher. Everybody thinks you're a great actor. That kind of fame. People spend all their energy and risk their lives for it. And then what? You know, like name like the 10 top actors of 1921. Where are they now? Like, who cares? fame and notoriety, which is the opposite of fame, that's the disgrace part, are both no more than an empty echo. Your reputation is an alluring mirage that can easily lead you astray. Discard it without a second thought, like the snot you blow from your nose. This may be the only Dharma book by a great teacher that contains the word snot. That is how little regard we should have for what people think of us. Gosh, if only we could be like that. But that can be a negative thing too. Like, people can do very bad things from a point of view of not caring what other people think. So we have to remember to stay on the bodhisattva side of things. And I just want to bring in Geshe Jampa Tegcho just a little bit, Transforming the Heart. Because he had a very lovely, he has a lot of very good things. He also, karma is very important. And he says, if we retaliate, like if we get angry, if we retaliate, and Gampopa goes into this too, it only causes us more suffering. If we retaliate, they will be unhappy and the conflict will escalate and they will continue to say many bad things about us. Also, it just disturbs our own mind. So anyway, and about saying good things about them, which is what we're supposed to do, right? Let's see. We're supposed to, right, to pay them back, I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character. But how can we do that about a really bad person? Geshe Jampa Tegcho says, there is no sentient being who is devoid of good qualities. We can look for those good qualities and speak of them with a loving attitude that wants this person to have happiness in its causes. So you can find some good way to think about them. You don't have to go around and like make a show of it, like telling everybody what a good person this other person is. But to know in your heart, that's where compassion comes from. And again, you know, the story of when I was in 3-year retreat and I kept a running list of something nice everybody had done for me so that when they upset me, I could look at the list, and it really dissolved it. It really, really does the job. If you have difficult people in your life, think of something good about them that you can call upon. You know, just remember something, sometime they were nice to you, and you can call upon that when they do something that hurts you, and it really helps. So here's the paragraph. The great Atish, oh, well, I'm going to skip that. In the 8 verses, and that's the Galupa version of 7 Points of Mind Training, in the 8 verses, it says, when others out of jealousy mistreat me with abuse, slander, and so on, I will practice accepting defeat and offering the victory to them. So that's one of the linchpins, one of the foundation stones of 7 points of mind training in whatever tradition is accept all defeat. I will accept all defeat for myself and give all victory to others. He says, this means that when people are jealous of us and say all sorts of unpleasant things, criticizing us in many ways, we should give them the victory by agreeing with them and accept the defeat ourselves by concurring that we are at fault. So like Trungpa Rinpoche, he says, we just can say, okay, I did it. This does not mean, this is important, this does not mean that we blame ourselves in a psychologically unhealthy way whenever something goes wrong. Rather, and this is the crux of it, rather it means that we give up having to be right, having to have the last word, and having to prove ourselves. We sort of just let things be. We can, as Anne said about a previous verse, we can just relax. We don't have to put the force fields up. Just let it wash over us. So I'm going to pull up Ken McLeod's commentary. Just have a few minutes. I'm going to start reading from the beginning. And again, as he's done with previous verses, he just plunges us in the middle of a situation. If Marilyn and Patrick O'Hara would use the Latin term in medias res, in the middle of the thing, which is where Greek, you know, the Greek playwrights and Roman playwrights, they all plunge us into the middle of the action in medias res. The rumor is all over town. Everyone is talking about it. People ask you again and again, how could you do that? No matter how often you say, I didn't, or it wasn't like that, the questions and censures keep coming. Your protests carry little weight. We have all lived this. I lived this pretty recently. The questions and your protests carry little weight. Whatever you say, others twist and turn it against you. The rumor starts to spread on the internet. A popular blog picks it up, or Tricycle magazine, or, you know, Shambhala. people who have no connection with you and know nothing about your about you comment on your supposedly abhorrent behavior. Another site picks it up, and then another. Every time you hear about it, every time you read about it, you feel as if you have been physically attacked. Your guts tighten up. Your chest hurts. You double over and you have trouble breathing. Anger, shock, incredulity, worry, fear, and panic flood you. You have become an icon of misbehavior, a symbol of what people most hate and fear. So this guts tightening up, chest hurting, trouble breathing, these are the force field, like you're using all your energy to keep your force field in place. And you don't have control over it. You know, I mean, you don't. So it's going to happen, but that's where you can start to relax. So to go on, you know who is responsible. You know exactly how the rumor started, but there is nothing you can do about it. The rumor monger is impervious to your entreaties and seemingly intent on making as many people as possible see you in the worst possible light. You do not want to go out. When you do, your only hope is that no one recognizes you. You feel victimized, violated, isolated, cut off from all ordinary human connection. You are angry and want to strike back, refuting the charges, defending your reputation, and attacking the source of the rumors. You want revenge. You want justice. You want your life back. You want to retaliate, if only not to feel so helpless, but you do feel helpless. And here's the zinger, like, this is what we can remember. Your every thought is centered on you. It's team I, it's me, like, you know, this is not fair to me. I did not do this. I feel terrible. I can't breathe. Every thought is about you. You are concerned about the damage and the harm that these rumors are doing to those who know you, respect you, or look up to you. Even then, it is still about you. Now we get into the solution. So what do you do? What do you do? He says, start here. And he's going to start with the wisdom side. And then he's going to go to the compassion side. The wisdom side is, every idea you have about you is not true. They are just ideas. Every idea others have about you is not true. They are just ideas. Can we relate to that? Like, if we've studied the skandhas at all, we understand that we are not any particular thing, and we change from moment to moment and situation to situation. We don't even know who we are. How can we expect other people to know who we are, to really get it? So once you've done that, that's touching in with the dreamlike quality. Like, this is just a dream. This is just a passing experience. This is going to be over tomorrow or in an hour. And none of it's really true. Or the basic definition of emptiness. No situation is limited to being the way that I perceive it. That goes for you about yourself. That goes for you about other people. And that goes for other people about you. And other people about themselves. I mean, don't you love? I really notice, like, when people are attacked, like somebody says somebody did something wrong and the other person says, no, but this is what I meant. This is what I was thinking. And we always, when we're the person doing the attacking, we always think we're right and they're just trying to to justify, to rationalize. But when we're the one that's attacked, we think that it's our point of view and our intention that's really meaningful, and they just don't get it. I don't know if I expressed that clearly, but there's like a two-sided thing here. And how we look at the situation is different depending on which side we're on. And if you can see that, then you can apply that when you're in a situation. It makes you less sure in your attacking of somebody else, and it makes you less defensive in somebody else attacking you. because you understand that your points of view are just different and that neither one is really ultimately correct. So he says, now, once you've done that, you've connected with the wisdom aspect. Now begin taking and sending. And because we're almost out of time, I'll just read selectively. But it is very beautiful how he says it here. And he has us go through every possible aspect of the situation and do taking and sending for every single aspect. So he says, begin by taking in the pain of everyone who has felt the stabs of ugly rumors and bled from the slashes of false or misleading accusations. I get the feeling he's lived this too. Send them your own experience of being respected and praised, loved and admired. So this is that practice where when we're angry, we think, let me just take all the anger of all beings. Since I'm experiencing anger, let me just take everybody's anger and they can be free of it. And I'll send everybody my happiness. So now it's a specific kind of emotional reaction, the pain of being unfairly maligned. So other people, everybody, every being in the universe has experienced being unfairly maligned. I'm going to take that all into mine. So that's the first kind of taking and sending we can do, and sending them our happiness. Whatever, he says, send to them whatever you know from your own life that soothes the hurts, diffuses the anger, and releases the bitterness. So he goes a little more into that. And then he says, step two, so you've done it now for your own pain. Now open and take in the pain that drives your attacker. Take it into your pain and hurt. Feel all of it as deeply as you can, and in return, send your understanding and appreciation. So first we acknowledge our own pain, and we remember everybody else has experienced that too. We breathe that in, we breathe out the good stuff. Now, whatever pain the attacker is acting from, we breathe that in, along with everybody else who's experienced that, and we breathe out to them understanding. He says, as you do this, and again, I'm skipping parts here, but he says, as you do this, you see too how attached you are to your reputation. So this is where we can remember the eight worldly concerns. Like, okay, this is about fame versus disgrace, and I'm really hurt by this. So I have to work on equanimity. So he says, as you do this, you see too how attached you are to your reputation. Take in the attachment. So now we can breathe in our attachment, our ego clinging, basically, our attachment to having people think well of us. Take in the attachment and the pain of the attachment, and so forth. So here's how he ends. No, this isn't quite how he ends it, but I'm going to read this bit. Bit by bit, you see that there is nothing in you to be attacked. We're back to the emptiness part now. Nothing in you to be attacked, slandered, or victimized, and nothing to be praised, respected, or idolized. Like neither side of the eight worldly concerns equation is really it. It's something else. You see that you are not your reputation. You do not own your reputation. It does not belong to you. It is not you, and it is not yours. It is a collection of thoughts and feelings in the minds of others. Something, when you have this realization, when you really have it, something in you lets go. You realize that you cannot control the world. Now, from all beings, take in the pain of not being able to control your own life and send the joy of living without hope and fear. I'm going to read that again because I know when you're hearing, it's hard to like really grab it. Breathe in from all beings the pain of not being able to control your own life. We all experience that constantly. And send out the joy or the freedom of life without hope and fear, like freedom from hope and fear. In these ways, he says, use taking and sending to experience every aspect of slander and being slandered, and of praise and being praised, both sides. When you can experience everything, the good and the bad, there is nothing you need to grasp or oppose. So he ends by saying, many people just pay lip service to these instructions. They retreat into an idealization of what it means to be a bodhisattva. They use the behavioral codes to mask their own anger and hurt and do not let themselves feel the intensity of their own pain. I think this is akin to what's called spiritual bypassing, where we sort of go straight to meditation pretending like we're not this person who's got all of these nasty emotions, you know, roiling around inside us. So he's saying we should let ourselves feel the intensity of what we're feeling. And then we can apply the remedies of first seeing it as not ultimately real. And then second, doing taking and sending for it. So he says about people who can't do that, he says it's understandable. It is often unthinkably frightening to experience what goes on inside you. But if you wish to be free, you have no choice. So this is the path of freedom. This very difficult path, this Bodhisattva boot camp path, is the path of freedom. Yes, Valerie, I'm going to try to. Oh, yeah.
Lama, those emotions, the bad ones, they must have a purpose, though, right?
I don't know. I don't know that they have a purpose, but they have a reality that we're not seeing. The negative emotions are the wisdoms. Ultimately, that's the teaching. The five poisons are the five wisdoms, and they're just distorted in our perception, and that is confusion. That is the confusion of samsara. Anger is like the wisdom. I'm probably not going to remember all of them, but like wisdom, for example. I mean, anger is like the wisdom. No, I better not even try. But like there's a wisdom of seeing everything as equal, and there's a wisdom of seeing everything clearly. And there's a mirror-like wisdom. I can't remember which one is which emotion transformed, but we're seeing them in a distorted way. So, but the purpose of them is, if we can use it, I see you, Dave. The purpose of them is to remind us to apply the remedies, to remind us that they are, it's all wisdom energy. And if we can let go of the storyline and just experience the energy of it, it's actually wisdom. And it's going to lead us to wisdom. I can't unmute you, Dave. You'll have to do it there. Okay.
I was just going to ask you if the transmutation of the poisons into the wisdoms is, that's related to the five Buddhas, right?
Yeah, it's all one thing. It's all one thing. Each Buddha corresponds to one of the wisdoms. It's not always 100% like the same correspondence, like in different practices, you can have different things correspond to like differently. And the main point is like, we call it transmutation or transformation, but it's a reality already. It is our nature. The nature of the five poisons is the five wisdoms. And as sentient beings stuck in samsara, we don't see it that way. We feel them as negative emotions, which cause us to accumulate negative karma. And what we're trying to do here is to interfere in that process, that habitual process. If we can interfere with our habits of reacting emotionally and then acting on that reaction, if we can interrupt that process, we can start to see and experience the five wisdoms in place of the five poisons. Okay, anybody else before we do our prayers? All right, then I'm going to, right, thank you. Then we're going to do our prayers. I find this such a powerful verse. All of these verses in Bodhisattva Boot Camp have basically the same message, but from a different point of view and a different experience, a different sort of feeling tone of experience or a different actual thing that happens. But it's all the same. You know, we want to disidentify from our emotional reaction and act from our Bodhisattva aspirations. So Mutu, Tokme Zangpo here is helping us identify like specifically how we might react in specific situations to connect with the Bodhisattva level of practice instead of the digging deeper into samsara practice, how to use these situations to free ourselves and to awaken wisdom and compassion instead of digging ourselves deeper into samsara. As Pema Chodron often says, it's a very meaningful way to spend your life, to, you know, studying, contemplating, and meditating on these practices. So we will now dedicate the merit to all sentient beings. Again, let's just take a moment to connect with that vast, spacious awareness, opening ourselves out completely to the entire universe with absolute simplicity and nakedness of mind. Let's do that. And remember that vast, limitless space is filled with sentient beings who are suffering because of confusion, because of experiencing the five wisdoms as the five poisons. And we're going to dedicate to them any benefit from these teachings so that they can free themselves, with the aspiration that they free themselves from all suffering. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntus, Anko, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And just coming to rest, letting our minds come to rest one more time. In the feeling of being in our body, in this place, wherever we are, in this present moment. Just vividly alive. And I'm unmuting everybody. You're all unmuted. Danny, are you still with us? Going between workplaces, so I'm not sure she was with us all the time.
Yes, thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for my work. I found this very beneficial and was helpful to a couple of patients I was with this morning.
Great. So, glad you could be with us, Fanny. Very glad you could join us.
Thank you for doing that. I know.
Okay.
I'm doing my best.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, no problem. Okay, see you.
I have more to say about what you talk, but I'll write you about it.
Okay. Okay, great. Alrighty.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye. Okay. All right. Bye, Valerie. Bye, everybody.